ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
After a 4-week trial, Rajwinder Singh was sentenced to life in prison for murdering Toya Cordingley. In this episode, what we really think about the trial and the verdict. I'm Stephen Stockwell. Welcome to the case of Toya's murder.
The body of Toya Cordingley was found at Wongeti Beach, north of Cairns.
Her face adorns billboards and stickers across the region.
Searching for clues in the murder of the 24-year-old pharmacy worker.
Alongside the idyllic and isolated beaches.
The jury returned to say that they all agreed that Rajwinder Singh was guilty.
It has been just over a week since Rajwinder Singh was found guilty of murdering Toya Cordingley on Wongeti Beach in 2018. ABC Far North reporter Chris Tester has been with us during the trial to help us tell this story. Chris, thank you so much for being with us and joining us through this whole process.
No, thanks, Stocky.
No, look, you've been a welcome addition to the Case of team. And in our final episode with you, I want to spend a bit of time analysing the trial, answering some questions that we've been sent through. And something that we do at the end of any trial that we cover is we tell people what we really think, kind of analysing the trial, picking out key moments, key evidence, and, you know, talking about what we were thinking at certain points and around the outcome. And the other person that I spend a lot of time talking to this about is Case's executive producer, Claire Rawlinson. Welcome, Claire.
Hello.
There's much that we have to unpack and talk through with this. You know, Chris, we're talking about this all the time. Claire, you and I are talking about this all the time. So, yeah, very interested in hearing your thoughts on the verdict and the key evidence throughout. Chris, to get us going, were you surprised by the verdict?
No, I don't think it's a total surprise. And you, as a journalist covering court cases, you can never truly be surprised by what a jury comes back with. But you have to remember there was a lot of evidence presented to the jury in this case. It ran over more than 3 weeks. And I've heard evidence from the first trial earlier this year as well. And we kind of unpicked it a bit in the last podcast. But there was a bit of homework done by the Crown after the first trial. You know, a bit more evidence brought to the courtroom as well that may have answered some of the questions that people were left hanging with during the first trial. For example, that hair that was found in Toya Cordingley's hand, which during the first trial we heard wasn't submitted for testing. It was eventually tested, and the results that were able to be produced showed that it was Toya's hair. So I think a lot of that homework had been done, and the case had kind of really been firmed up.
And Claire, what about you? Were you surprised by the verdict we saw?
I wasn't surprised. I think that, you know, you think about the jury's task is to find guilt beyond reasonable doubt. And so is it really reasonable to imagine that Singh could have, as he described in this undercover interview with the police officer, could have witnessed a murder and then also driven along the same route that Toya's mobile travelled? And also have had his DNA at the scene and fled the country instead of going to police. That's what you would need to believe. All of those things are kind of coincidences in order to think that he's not guilty. Mm. And, you know, going to the defence's closings, the way that they addressed the scientific evidence was to kind of just suggest that the jury should not necessarily trust the science. Mm. And then the defence that Singh made of witnessing a murder and fleeing, that was just never really fleshed out. Mm. And so I think the jury would have needed him to go into the witness box and actually explain in a bit more detail why witnessing that would have led him to flee the country instead of going to the police.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest thing for me was the kind of the post-defence conduct, right? Like, it's him leaving the country after the murder of Toya Cordingley on Wongeti Beach. You know, the timing of that, I think, was just, you know, pretty suspicious if you're to believe his story. And then, Chris, something you were saying in one of our episodes over the last week, just pointing out the fact that Rajwinder Singh told a different story about why he left the country to every single person he spoke to about leaving the country. And that, for me, really sort of sealed off that. And then also, you know, the movement of the phone, the other evidence as well, that's what really tied it to him. But I was immediately suspicious when I kind of heard the story of him him leaving the country in that way.
I think there was also a little lack of clarity from his defence about why he left the country, because there were times when we heard about him witnessing a murder, and then there were other times where the defence raised, you know, the possibility of an unhappy marriage being a reason for leaving. So even that was just, it was too muddied and vague.
I just wanted to jump back a step as well, because there's a lot of detail in this trial, and just the sheer volume of it means we can only focus on certain bits. So the jury gets to hear all of it. And one point that may not have necessarily come through if you're following along from home was the Crown went to this kind of story that Rajwinder Singh had told about, you know, witnessing this murder on the beach and leaving in fear. And they actually kind of followed his journey away from the beach to back home to Innisfail that evening. And Nathan Crane actually kind of went through the vision in his closing address to the jury. And he focused on some of the cars that were seen coming behind Rajwinder Singh in that intersection, and kind of the fact that they weren't off in different directions. And he really did this to make the point that there was no one following him. Like, there was no other car moving in the same direction that the Alfa Romeo did, which kind of went to attacking the credibility of that story that Rajwinder Singh tells of, you know, I saw this happen and I was worried these people could come and find me and could even come and get me in the Cairns watch house all these years later. That actually the vision shows there was no one even following him from the beach that evening.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that points to Rajwinder Singh being the person who murdered Toy accordingly. But, I mean, there's also stories that the defence was telling and other ways that the defence was trying to direct the jury, you know, in defending their client, in defending Rajwinder Singh. I mean, Chris, was there anything that gave you pause throughout the trial that made you wonder or made you think, oh, maybe, you know, there is another story here than the one that the prosecution is telling? I mean, we saw, like, you know, in some cases, you know, low likelihoods of DNA. You know, we didn't hear anything about a knife. We heard that Rajwinder Singh didn't carry a knife and there was no knife recovered. And we also heard a lot about alternate suspects as well. I mean, was there anything in that that made you kind of think or question the story being told by the Crown?
More looking at whether or not the defence would be able to create enough reasonable doubt in the jury's mind. I think it's fair to say on the evidence, the greatest amount of evidence pointing to the fact that Rajwinder Singh killed Toy accordingly, but you need to look at whether, you know, the defence can sow enough doubt that even one juror kind of just isn't willing to commit to a guilty verdict. And for me, during the trials, it really focused on kind of these unanswered questions. Not so much the people who the police did look into. We know we heard these names like Marco Hardenreich, Toy's boyfriend, and Evan McRae. And a lot of time was spent on these witnesses. But that also meant the Crown was able to present, you know, quite compelling evidence just to show that they simply weren't there. And I kind of thought during the trial that the path to a reasonable doubt might just be kind of this unanswered question, you know, the random person who no one has been able to follow up. In the first trial, we heard about this car, one of the 70 that police weren't able to exclude because they kind of weren't able to work out where it had gone. And there was a lot less of that during the second trial. You know, I've already mentioned the hair that was found in Toya's hand that was subsequently tested. Mm. For me, that was kind of the area that, you know, the grey in between the black and white that I kind of thought the defence would spend most of its energy on.
Mm, yeah, and I mean, Claire, you and I spent a lot of time talking about some of the other people involved around the beach, around Wangetti Beach on this day, also with connections to Toy accordingly. And I mean, you know, you can see the kind of the story around Marco Hardenreich being a potential suspect in this, right?
I just thought it was so interesting, the focus that there was from not only our listeners, but every time I would have conversations with people about this case, there was just such suspicion on Marco. And I think, like, I can understand why there was that suspicion, because in a way it's the explanation that I think people want to believe, because it would be less random, it would be less, it would make us less scared, you know, women in the public in general, that it sort of is something that's a little bit more, we're familiar with intimate partner violence. Mm. And there were some little kind of things that could have painted a picture against Marco. For example, you know, Toya was developing a bit of a love interest with this podiatrist, Tyson Franklin. Marco had a connection to a police officer in Queensland. Like, all of these things that really proved to be nothing in the end, but that gave people like more of the clear narrative that I think was missing from Rajwinder Singh being the person who was on trial.
Mm. Yeah, I want to talk a bit more about the kind of the story of what unfolded on the beach a little bit later, because we've had a lot of questions about how what unfolded on the beach was framed by Justice Crowley during his sentencing remarks. But I think Marco's a really interesting person in this, because it's like, it's Occam's razor, right? Like, it's the most obvious suspect. You know, this is the person who, you know, has the closest connection to her. We know so much about intimate partner violence. We hear so much about that. It is kind of, you know, it seems like where you should be looking. Yeah. Chris, what do you think about the way that Marco was kind of, you know, framed during the trial?
Yeah, as you said, it makes sense. He was the first person the police looked at. Like, we heard evidence during the trial that as soon as this happened, he, you know, his phone was being seized, you know, his clothes and his car were being forensically examined. There was a quote from Nathan Crane at the closing of the first trial, the one that ended in the hung jury. And he spoke not just about Marco, but also these other men who the defence had raised. And he made the point that these people were all investigated by police in a way that Rajwinder Singh was not able to be, because he'd left. They did go to his house in November 2018, you know, 3 weeks, 4 weeks after Toya's death, once they'd kind of connected him or found this blue Alfa Romeo. And they did some testing, but there's only limited amounts of things you can do. You know, you can't download someone's phone, you can't send it away to Canberra, as they were able to do with Marco's phone. And I think one thing that really shaped, perhaps not the jury's version of it, the jury is deciding based on what they hear presented in court. But in terms of this kind of court of public opinion, we've heard that Marco Heidenreich's been a real victim of kind of the way the defence has run this case, that they've essentially accused him of murder. Is a lot of that stuff about Marco and Tyson Franklin actually emerged for the first time during the pre-trial hearings, which were in 2024. And Rajwinder Singh had only had kind of cursory mentions of his case in the magistrate's court. So those pre-trial hearings post his extradition were really the first we were able to report any detail of this case. And so that's just kind of by default what a lot of the news coverage focused on. And I think that has kind of influenced the way a lot of onlookers have looked at this case, because kind of Rajwinder Singh was brought back to Australia, very high profile extradition, very, you know, extraordinary circumstances, and there was a lot of frenzy around that. And then it was quite a long time before we heard anything in court, and when we were, it was all about, you know, Toya was talking to Tyson Franklin, and kind of it's the pre-trial is the defense's opportunity to kind of test what they see as potentially the weakest part of the Crown case, right? So the first the public really gets to hear about the nitty-gritty of what the Crown is presenting was this kind of salacious stuff about Marco Heidenreich and Tyson Franklin. And I think that kind of coupled with the fact that Angus Edwards in the first trial opened his address to the jury with, you know, this case was flawed from the start and that the police had put all their eggs in one basket, that kind of sets in people's minds when they're reading about the case, and they're not able to follow along, you know, as best as you can follow this case in great detail through, you know, things like our podcast and the news coverage. But there's really no substitute for what the jury gets to hear, which is everything. And I think that's really where Marco Heidenreich has sadly kind of become a tragic victim of the way that narrative was put out into the community.
The point you make, Chris, about how much detail and how much the jury hears, you know, we do our best to kind of condense it all into, you know, half an hour or so. We're doing that for a couple of days. And so there's so much more that is heard by people in the room. And we did see, you know, people in Cairns coming into that space, coming into the courtroom, watching the proceedings along. And I think it pointed to probably just the impact that this has, the connection that people had with this trial. And then that's something we've seen in the case of Inbox as well. You know, we've had emails from people all over the country, but also, you know, specifically from North Queensland. I mean, there's a couple who just spring to mind at the moment. I mean, Kat, I remember getting an email from, lives nearby and walks her dog on Wangetti Beach, I think. And following the trial, Simon emailed as well, saying that his daughter was a similar age to Toya Cordingley, similar build, and was just talking about the relief that someone had been kind of found guilty of this crime. So I think, you know, he would relax a little bit. I mean, Claire, is that something that you think would have been kind of, you know, kind of pervasive in North Queensland, this kind of fear and concern with this being unresolved?
I can only imagine. I mean, I think back to when I lived in Darwin, and just like such a part of your lifestyle when you live in Northern Australia is being able to enjoy freely these beautiful beaches. And that's like, it becomes, I think, even a part of your identity as a person who lives in these areas. And so to have that so tainted by something like this, and particularly for women who would fear that situation now every time they walk on the beach, and even more so people walking with their dogs think that have previously thought that that would keep them safe, that this challenged that as well. But I think this case just really struck a chord nationally, because to me it's such a sad picture of how Toya was, she was really surrounded by violence, but potentially not being aware of it at all. She was someone who her family described as being incredibly positive, outlook on life, a kind and caring person. And it is chilling to me that she was in such close proximity to violence at multiple points, but even particularly at Wanganui Beach. You know, for example, we know that Singh was there. There was also Evan McRae, who has a history of violence. And then Joshua James Richards, who was the so-called Mossman killer, who only 3 days earlier had committed a violent murder in that region. And then Tyson Franklin, who she was developing a love interest in and was later found to have child abuse material on his phone. Mm. I mean, she was surrounded by violence, but probably very unaware. And I think of just, you know, coming back to how it's affected the Cairns community and how it just changes these beautiful, special places. It's kind of like how I imagine Bondi will now be tainted. Like, you won't be able to go to these places without remembering them. There's a spot on the corner that I pass every day on the way into work, King's Domain, where several years ago a young woman, a chef, pastry chef Renee Lau, was bashed to death and raped. And I don't pass that place without thinking about it. It's just, that's a result of these awful murders.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I think every time I end up in Martin Place in Sydney, I think of the Link Cafe and the siege that was there over a decade ago as well. So, yeah, these things do really kind of stick in your mind and mark those places, like you're saying.
I guess just a little point about Wanganui Beach. I drive to Port Douglas reasonably often, as we all do up here, because it's one of the most beautiful drives in the country, anywhere, probably in the world, that Captain Cook Highway along the coast. You get these sweeping coastal views. It's spectacular. I've only been to Wanganui Beach twice, and both were the jury viewings of this case, because, I don't know, there's just a little something that kind of nags at me when the thought is to pull over and take a walk and check it out, and because I associate it with this murder.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, it is such a beautiful area, Wanganui Beach. I remember flying into Cairns and looking out the window and realising the beach that the plane was turning over was Wanganui Beach. It's like beautiful, long beach, you know, mountains on one side covered in rainforest and the ocean on the other. It is this, yeah, beautiful spot. But yeah, now it does have that kind of feeling attached to it. And there's so much as well that we don't know about what happened on that day in October 2018 when Toya Cordingley was murdered. I mean, we didn't hear that much evidence presented about what might have actually unfolded on the beach. But we did have theories. I had a theory about what unfolded. And Justice Crowley, in his sentencing remarks, kind of, you know, went quite a long way to sort of suggesting what may have unfolded on that beach. You know, Rajwinder Singh, you know, doing something he shouldn't have been doing in the sand dunes, being caught, maybe filmed by Toya Cordingley. And Chris, we got a lot of questions about how far he went there, given that there was no evidence presented on what unfolded on that beach. I'm thinking of Beck, Lisa, Paul, Linda, you know, a handful of people who've emailed. We would have had probably a dozen emails about this, actually. How did Justice Crowley get to the point where he was kind of telling a story about what Rajwinder Singh might have done on that day? And is that an inappropriate thing for a judge to do?
Not at all. Before a judge hands down sentence and reads his remarks, and indeed probably finishes writing the remarks, there is a bit of a pause. So some thought goes into this, and he does take submissions from both the Crown Prosecutor and Rajwinder Singh's barrister. And that kind of theory or possible explanation was something that was kind of vaguely outlined in the closing address to the jury by Nathan Crane, when he was saying, you know, to the jury, there's no evidence of motive, you don't need to conclude one, you know, kind of, you could potentially think these things happened as a kind of a way to draw the dots together, but the fact is we simply don't know. And then again, once the guilty verdict's been returned, Nathan Crane is able to say, look, there's no evidence, but it's open to you on the facts to conclude this is a possible explanation. The defence didn't really take it much further, and they speak after the prosecution does. They just said, look, on the Crown case, it's a kind of an opportunistic attack on a beach. There wasn't really a lot of greater detail offered there. So I guess without a strong rebuttal or any alternate version of events put forward by Rajwinder Singh, or, you know, there was certainly no full explanation where he kind of comes clean and says, look, I know I ran my case saying this, but this is actually what happened. Mm. The judge is open to, you know, surmising what, you know, potentially the most likely explanations were. And he didn't say this is what happened. He said this is a plausible kind of explanation that you were doing something inappropriate. It was probably sexual and depraved. And, you know, the fact that you've taken her phone means perhaps she either challenged you or took a photo or a video, which I have to say is kind of what I had thought was the most likely explanation for this during the case and on the evidence that we heard. I can say that this wasn't presented to the jury, but I know that Toy accordingly, a few months before she died, posted to Facebook, she actually shared a video, which was about a woman calling out inappropriate behavior towards her, and she actually shared that video with the comment, you know, anytime, anywhere, any place, this is not okay. So she was someone who had expressed, you know, views against inappropriate behavior towards women in a public place, and, you know, kind of commending it from being called out. Now, that wasn't put to a court, that's just an observation I made, but you know, it might give you a little bit of insight into, you know, the fact that she could have held strong views about that sort of thing.
Mm.
In a place that she loved.
Yeah. We heard during the trial that Wanggedi Beach was a place that Toy accordingly would travel to, you know, on occasion to walk her dog, Indy. Claire has been talking about this is a huge case in Cairns. You know, there were all these other theories around who may have been responsible for this. Do you think that the reason Justice Crowley kind of told that story about Rajwinder Singh was a way of getting the public to kind of accept the decision and the verdict?
I think that's a benefit of it, because in the absence of a clear narrative, there is so much space for these sort of set up conspiracy theories that we've received emails about. Mm. You know, did someone put Toya's phone in Rajwinder Singh's car and that's why the pings were connected, that kind of thing. Mm. But I also think it sounds like Justice Crowley has a really clear opinion of what happened, and he gave us as much as he could about that opinion. And another thing that I thought was a really incisive observation that he made in his sentencing remarks was about the CCTV footage of Rajwinder Singh earlier in the day, and that Justice Crowley said he looked like he was people watching when he was at the shopping centre, and then he went to Wanggedi Beach where he could be alone and his darker desires and his true self could emerge uninhibited. Mm. And I think it shows how Justice Crowley has made sense of what's gone on, and that actually, I think there's value in that because, yeah, like I said, without it, it just feels so random and feels like maybe like in 30 years from now, there'll be some podcast or some documentary that will uncover that actually there was something missing from the investigation. But and coupled with that Facebook video, Chris, that you found, that I don't know whether Justice Crowley would have seen it or not, but that's a really haunting and sad thing to know.
I think it's also about calling out something that Rajwinder Singh has clearly tried to keep under wraps, though, right? Like, at no point post his arrest, you know, he was reported as having said some things in India after he was arrested, but before he was brought back to Australia. Now, those versions were never put to the jury. He wasn't saying them to the undercover police officer in that secret recording where he kind of gave his version of events. But, you know, we heard one version that it was attributed by an Indian newspaper to Delhi police, that this confrontation between Rajwinder Singh and Toy accordingly had erupted over her dog barking. And I kind of feel like perhaps there was a sense of there's a shameful element to whatever he was doing, if it was sexually inappropriate behaviour, and whatever version he's giving of what happened, however much he admits to knowing what went on, none of that ever makes it in, right? So I think perhaps there's an element of Justice Crowley wanting to kind of call that out and really put it on the record and put it to Rajwinder Singh directly to his face in the dock, that, you know, kind of the jury's found you guilty, you now can't run away from this and this fact as well.
Because he did really want to expose Rajwinder Singh as a coward. He said that so clearly in his sentencing remarks and pointed out how everything Rajwinder Singh had done was in self-interest, you know, abandoning his family, leaving them without the ability to pay the mortgage on their house, like never speaking to his children again. And then also putting Toy Accordingly's family through not one but two trials where they had to give this horrendous evidence of their experience. All of that goes to, as Justice Crowley said, his true self being Rajwinder Singh being a coward.
Mm. We spoke a lot, you know, in this episode about the kind of the evidence that, you know, we were all thinking about and reflecting on through the trial, and, you know, how we weren't really that surprised with the verdict that the jury returned in the end. But, you know, throughout this trial, we've had a huge amount of engagement from people listening to the case of. There's been a lot of interest in what we've been producing. Claire, what do you think has kind of drawn people to it? Was it the mystery of what has happened and what's unfolded throughout this, or was it something else?
It's interesting because this is the case that since covering the Aaron Patterson trial, this is the case that has seen the most engagement of everything we've covered since then. And I think for women, it's the feeling that this could happen to any one of us, the randomness of it. The comments that I got from people were always around just the struggle to make sense of such a senseless killing. And in particular, just even the fact that there wasn't a sexual assault left us all kind of perplexed, like sort of used to women being raped and then killed. But the idea that this could have happened without that as a motive. But also, I don't think a lot of women intuited what Justice Crowley did, which was that there was still something sexually perverted going on. It wasn't a rape of Toya, but that was an element of this murder. And so I think that it's the kind of universal fear that it strikes amongst women that made people particularly interested in this case and just wanting to understand how it could have happened.
The how and the why is the thing that I kind of kept coming back to as well. And, you know, I landed on probably about a third or halfway through the trial, a very similar kind of story to what Justice Crowley ended up, you know, giving us at the end of the trial.
I was going to ask what your theory was.
Yeah, and that's what I was thinking, you know, from about halfway through, was that Rajwinder Singh was, you know, doing something he shouldn't have been doing in the sand dunes. Toy accordingly has seen him, has filmed or taken a photo of him doing that, which is why Rajwinder Singh has taken her phone. Mm-hmm. And then that has led to the confrontation that's ended up seeing her murdered.
I also remember the day that I read that theory as well on Reddit, and I think I told you when I was reading it. And it just sort of everything felt like it clicked into place then. It was like, oh, okay, I don't have any questions now. Like this is the explanation that hasn't been made explicit.
I think Claire's really, yeah, got to the heart of it there. It's the sheer, I guess, brazenness of it and the fact that it really could have happened to anyone. And like there's certainly no evidence at all that Toy accordingly was targeted in any way. In fact, on the evidence, she actually got to the beach at a point in time when Rajwinder Singh was already there. I think certainly in the Cairns community, you know, it goes to how well known and liked Toy was. You know, we've heard since 2018, but again more recently in recent days, for someone who was just 24, she touched so many people's lives. She, you know, she worked at an animal shelter in Port Douglas and spent a couple of years there, and a whole bunch of kind of groups of, you know, that look after animals have posted about Toya in the days since, you know, just about the way she was with dogs and cats. And, you know, she clearly had a wide network of friends, really well-liked, had a very positive outlook on life. There's a mural at an animal shelter now painted in her memory. There's the memorials, you know, I've spoken during this podcast about how her name is almost ubiquitous in Cairns. You say Toya to someone in Cairns, and even if they didn't know Toya personally, they'll be able to, you know, they know the case. And I don't know if I've ever seen a community as, you know, keenly interested in closure of a particular case to this extent before. And I think it goes to show, even though Cairns is a really, you know, it's a very large regional city, but everyone's kind of banded together on this. And there's a lot of support out there for her family and loved ones as well.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, talking about animals, Chris, the thing I was thinking about a lot throughout this trial was the role of animals in this case. It's, you know, we talked about how Toya Cordingley would sometimes get lost in the evidence that was being presented to court, but the animals that she loved still kind of cut through. Like, we heard a lot about Indy, her dog, through this case as well. And I find it, you know, a really interesting way that her legacy kind of, you know, cut through during the trial as well.
Yeah, and it's actually a really sad duty of mine to report. I know we've had some questions about Indy during this trial, and Indy actually had passed away a few years after Toya died. My understanding is she became unwell, and the family had to make the really difficult decision to put her down. Actually, one of Toya's loved ones came up to me during the trial and had been listening to the podcast and you know, and told me that. And the only reason I hadn't brought it up, even though I didn't appear that it would be relevant, was it wasn't something the jury had heard, wasn't put to the jury. So even something as innocuous as that, I didn't think was appropriate to report to you at the time. But, you know, that was a really difficult moment for the family. And there's been a whole lot of speculation about how Indy might have reacted or behaved, or, you know, how she came to be tied up on the beach that day. It's one of those things that we'll really never know. But it wasn't just Indy, you know. Marco Hardenreich had his two dogs, Jersey and Bentley, who lived with Toya in that house. We saw that bookshelf in their living room, which is just full of books about animals. And again, if you go through social media, you can see how much and how often Toya posted about caring for animals and the importance of animal welfare, that they really were central to her life. I mean, even Wangetti Beach, her mum gave evidence during the trial that when she was looking for Toya while she was still missing that night, she actually went to a walk along the dunes because she knew that Toya had a cat buried there and she would often go back to visit it, which I guess is kind of the tragic full circle of this story of one of the reasons why she may have chosen that beach on that day. Was it had a special memory to her and it was connected to her love of animals.
Mm. Chris, how do you think Toya Cordingley will be remembered?
I think she's being remembered first and foremost as a positive person. Everyone has really lovely things to say about her. You know, she was kind. You know, she had this positive spirit. She clearly loved the outdoors. She loved being positive. We heard, you know, we got a bit of an insight into her personality through these text messages. You know, she wanted to have a happy outlook every day. Her dad said that she made him a better person. She's clearly left a huge void in all of the lives of the people who are at court following this trial. And again, her legacy with animals in Far North Queensland is massive. Like, she's made in such a short time, she's made a huge impact on a lot of these volunteer organisations. And I think the sense was that she was destined really for bigger and better things. And there's a real lament there that, you know, it looked like her life was really on an upward trajectory and really going places. And, you know, people are really devastated that they won't get to see that pan out.
Yeah, I agree, Chris. And when Toya's father, Troy, spoke after the verdict and he said that the world would be poorer because Toya isn't in it, I completely understand that, because she just comes across as someone who had so much love to give. She just was so generous with her care for animals and her friends and family. And then just the fact that this image of a sunflower was the sort of motif that's been chosen to represent her, and that, you know, is on all of the stickers associated with her name. Like, forever in my mind, Toya's name will be associated with a sunflower.
Mm. You know, such a young woman when she was murdered in 2018 as well, you know, early 20s. Chris, as you were saying, you know, so much more that you know, she could have offered the world, and that was taken away far too soon by Rajwinder Singh, who's been convicted of her murder and will spend the rest of his life in prison unless he is, you know, given parole when that period comes through. Chris Tester, I want to say a huge thank you for taking us through this trial. There has been a lot that you've had to look at through this to bring it to the Case of audience and the, also the ABC online audience as well. Chris has written a fantastic feature on the trial. It's on ABC News at the moment, and I'll put a link to that in the episode description for this. There's something in that. You know, one of the questions we had a fair bit throughout this trial is, you know, whether or not Rajwinder Singh was a devout Sikh man. There's some photos in that article that will give you an idea of what he looked like before he left Australia for India. So I'd recommend checking that out. Again, the link will be in the episode description of this episode. And Chris, you've been really welcomed by the Case of family as well. We've had some effusive praise for you in the Case of inbox. And with that in mind, will this be the last that we hear from you?
Well, Rajwinder Singh has 28 days from the verdict to lodge an appeal with the Court of Appeal. So that date will roll around at the start of January. We'll bring you any updates that come to hand there if that does eventuate. And looking into a few other things about what this outcome means for him too, he'll be eligible for parole at the earliest in March 2048. Rajwinder Singh is an Australian citizen with overseas citizenship of India. So looking into what this verdict may mean in terms of, you know, whether he's ever going to be able to return to the country that he spent 4 years hiding out in after this horrible crime.
Mm. Well, look, potentially more for us to talk about at some point. But yeah, have really appreciated having you on the Case of. So thank you so much for being with us.
It's been an honour. Thank you.
And Claire Rawlinson, the Case of EP, thank you for joining us for this episode as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
We are nearing the end of the year, but we do still have plenty more for you in store. We have an update on the sentencing of Matt Wright, the Case of the Croc Wrangler. That'll be in your feed on Thursday. Some quite significant developments there, actually, one that I was very surprised with, and you'll find out why in that episode on Thursday. There's also been some movement in the Case of Snowtown Parole. A review has rejected James Lysakis's parole, but that decision has not gone down very well at all in South Australia. So we'll have news on that for you on Tuesday next week. If you have any questions, please get in touch, thecaseof@abc.net.au. If you send us enough about Toy Accordingly, we'll have to get Chris Tester back in the studio to talk more about it and answer those questions. And if you have anything else you want us to look at or questions about those other cases, please get in touch. And remember, the best place to listen to The Case Of is the ABC Listen app. There's always stuff happening. There's always new episodes coming out. I can never predict when we'll be doing one. So if you get yourself the ABC Listen app, you're in the best place to listen to The Case Of. The Case of Toya's murder is produced by ABC Audio Studios and ABC News. It's reported by Chris Tester and presented by me, Stephen Stockwell. Our supervising producer is Greg Muller and our executive producer is Claire Rawlinson. This episode was produced on the land of the Gimoy, Wallabara Yidinji and Wurundjeri people.